Journal.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you an hour of short stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to an hour of short stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. Today's program includes two short stories, both comedies with surprise endings, and both titled with the person's name. The first is Charles by Shirley Jackson, and the other is Mary Smith by Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Booth Tarkington. We have heard a short story by Jackson before, but this will be the first by Tarkington, one of the most popular novelists of his time. Shirley Jackson was born in 1916 in San Francisco and died at age 48 of heart failure. She was interested in witchcraft and believed she had supernatural powers, which perhaps explains why the style of her work has influenced Stephen King. She received the 1966 Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award for Best Short Story, The Possibility of Evil. Her best-known short story, which we have previously presented, was the very unsettling The Lottery. Here, however, is one of her more entertaining works, entitled Charles. The day my son Laurie started kindergarten, he renounced corduroy overalls with bibs and began wearing blue jeans with a belt. I watched him go off the first morning with the older girl next door, seeing clearly that an era of my life was ended. My sweet-voiced nursery school tot, replaced by a long-trousered, swaggering character who forgot to stop at the corner and wave goodbye to me. He came home the same way, the front door slamming open, his hat on the floor, and the voice suddenly becoming raucous, shouting, "Isn't anybody here?" At lunch he spoke insolently to his father, spilled his baby sister's milk, and remarked that his teacher said we were not to take the name of the Lord in vain. "How was school today?" I asked, elaborately casual. "All right," he said. "Did you learn anything?" his father asked. Laurie regarded his father coldly. "I didn't learn nothing," he said. "Anything," I said. "Didn't learn anything." "A teacher spanked a boy, though," Laurie said, addressing his bread and butter. "For being fresh," he added with his mouth full. "What did he do?" I asked. "Who was it?" Laurie thought. "It was Charles," he said. "He was fresh. The teacher spanked him and made him stand in a corner. He was awfully fresh." "What did he do?" I asked again, but Laurie slid off his chair, took a cookie and left, while his father was still saying, "See here, young man." The next day Laurie remarked at lunch, as soon as he sat down, "Well, Charles was bad again today." He grinned enormously and said, "Today Charles hit the teacher." "Good heavens," I said, mindful of the Lord's name. "I suppose he got spanked." "He sure did," Laurie said. "Look up," he said to his father. "What?" his father said, looking up. "Look down," Laurie said. "Look at my thumb. Gee, you're dumb." He began to laugh insanely. "Why did Charles hit the teacher?" I asked. "Because she tried to make him color with red crayons," Laurie said. "Charles wanted to color with green crayons, so he hit the teacher and she spanked him and said nobody play with Charles, but everybody did." The third day. It was Wednesday of the first week. Charles bounced a seesaw on the head of a little girl and made her bleed, and the teacher made him stay inside all during recess. Thursday, Charles had to stand in a corner during story time because he kept pounding his feet on the floor. Friday, Charles was deprived of blackboard privileges because he threw chalk. On Saturday, I remarked to my husband, "Do you think kindergarten is too unsettling for Laurie? All this toughness and bad grammar, and this Charles boy sounds like such a bad influence." "It'll be all right," my husband said reassuringly. "Bound to be people like Charles in the world. Might as well meet them now as later." On Monday, Laurie came home full of news. "Charles!" he shouted as he came up the hill. I was waiting anxiously on the front steps. "Charles!" Laurie yelled all the way up the hill. "Charles was bad again!" "Come right in," I said as soon as he came close enough. "Lunch is waiting."
"You know what Charles did?" he demanded, following me through the door. "Charles yelled so in school, they sent a boy in from first grade to tell the teacher she had to make Charles keep quiet, and so Charles had to stay after school, and so all the children stayed to watch him."
"What did he do?" I asked.
"He just sat there," Laurie said, climbing into his chair at the table. "Hi, Pop, you old dust mop."
"Charles had to stay after school today," I told my husband. "Everyone stayed with him."
"What does this Charles look like?" my husband asked Laurie. "What's his other name?"
"He's bigger than me," Laurie said, "and he doesn't have any rubbers and he doesn't ever wear a jacket."
Monday night was the first parent-teachers meeting, and the only fact that the baby had a cold kept me from going. I wanted passionately to meet Charles's mother. On Tuesday, Laurie remarked suddenly,
"Our teacher had a friend come to see her in school today."
"Charles's mother?" my husband and I asked simultaneously.
"Nah," Laurie said scornfully. "It was a man who came to make us do exercises. We had to touch our toes. Look."
He climbed down from his chair and squatted down and touched his toes.
"Like this," he said.
He got solemnly back into his chair and said, picking up his fork,
"Charles didn't even do exercises."
"That's fine," I said heartily. "Didn't Charles want to do the exercises?"
"Nah," Laurie said. "Charles was so fresh with the teacher's friend, he wasn't let to do exercises."
"Fresh again?" I said.
"He kicked the teacher's friend," Laurie said. "The teacher's friend told Charles to touch his toes, like I just did, and Charles kicked him."
"What are they going to do about Charles, do you suppose?" Laurie's father asked him. Laurie shrugged elaborately.
"Throw him out of school, I guess," he said.
Wednesday and Thursday were routine. Charles yelled during story hour and hit a boy in the stomach and made him cry. On Friday, Charles stayed after school again, and so did all the other children. With the third week of kindergarten, Charles was an institution in our family. The baby was being a Charles when he filled his wagon full of mud and pulled it through the kitchen. Even my husband, when he caught his elbow on the telephone cord and pulled telephone ashtray and a bowl of flowers off the table, said after the first minute, "Looks like Charles." During the third and fourth weeks, it looked like a reformation in Charles. Laurie reported grimly at lunch on Thursday of the third week,
"Charles was so good today, the teacher gave him an apple."
"What?" I said, and my husband added warily,
"You mean Charles?"
"Charles," Laurie said. "He gave the crayons around, and he picked up the books afterward, and the teacher said he was her helper."
"What happened?" I asked incredulously.
"He was her helper, that's all,"
Laurie said and shrugged.
"Can this be true about Charles?" I asked my husband that night. "Can something like this happen?"
"Wait and see," my husband said cynically. "When you've got a Charles to deal with, this may mean he's only plotting." He seemed to be wrong. For over a week, Charles was the teacher's helper. Each day he handed things out and he picked things up. No one had to stay after school. "The PTA meeting's next week again," I told my husband one evening. "I'm going to find Charles' mother there." "Ask her what happened to Charles," my husband said. "I'd like to know." "I'd like to know myself," I said. On Friday of the week, things were back to normal.
"You know what Charles did today?"
Laurie demanded at the lunch table in a voice slightly awed.
He told a little girl to say a word, and she said it, and the teacher washed her mouth out with soap, and Charles laughed.
What word? His father asked unwisely, and Laurie said,
I'll have to whisper it to you, it's so bad.
He got down off his chair and went around to his father. His father bent his head down, and Laurie whispered joyfully. His father's eyes widened.
Did Charles tell the little girl to say that?
He asked respectfully.
She said it twice, Laurie said. Charles told her to say it twice.
What happened to Charles? My husband asked.
Nothing,
Laurie said.
He was passing out the crayons.
Monday morning, Charles abandoned the little girl and said the evil word himself 3 or 4 times, getting his mouth washed out with soap each time. He also threw chalk. My husband came to the door with me that evening as I set out for the PTA meeting. Invite her over for a cup of tea after the meeting, he said. I want to get a look at her. If only she's there, I said prayerfully. She'll be there, my husband said. I don't see how they can hold a PTA meeting without Charles's mother. At the meeting, I sat restlessly, scanning each comfortable, matronly face, trying to determine which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them looked to me haggard enough. No one stood up in the meeting and apologized for the way her son had been acting. No one mentioned Charles. After the meeting, I identified and sought out Laurie's kindergarten teacher. She had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of chocolate cake. I had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of marshmallow cake. We maneuvered up to one another cautiously and smiled. I've been so anxious to meet you, I said. I'm Laurie's mother. We're all interested in Laurie, she said. Well, he certainly likes kindergarten, I said. He talks about it all the time.
We had a little trouble adjusting the first week or so, she said primly. But now he's a fine little helper, with occasional lapses, of course.
Laurie usually adjusts very quickly, I said. I suppose this time it's Charles's influence.
Charles?
Yes, I said, laughing. You must have your hands full in that kindergarten with Charles.
Charles?
She said.
We don't have any Charles in the kindergarten.
Author Booth Tarkington was born in 1869 in Indianapolis. Named for his maternal uncle and California Governor Newton Booth, he attended Purdue and graduated from Princeton University. Tarkington was one of the most popular novelists of his time and is best known for his Pulitzer Prize novels, The Magnificent Ambersons and Alice Adams. Booth died in Indianapolis in 1946. From among Tarkington's works, we have chosen the very entertaining short story entitled Mary Smith. Henry Millick Chester, rising early from intermittent slumbers, found himself the first of the crowded Pullman to make a toilette in the men's smoke and washroom, and so had the place to himself, an advantage of high dramatic value to a person of his age and temperament, on account of the mirrors which, set at various angles, afforded a fine view of the profile. Henry Millick Chester, scouring cinders and stickiness from his eyes, and rubbing his ears with honest friction, enriched himself of this too unfamiliar opportunity. He smiled and was warmly interested in the results of his smile in reflection, particularly in some pleasant alterations it effected upon an outline of the cheek, usually invisible to the bearer. He smiled graciously. Then he smiled sardonically. Other smiles he offered, the tender smile, the forbidding smile, the austere and the seductive, the haughty and the pleading, the mordant and compassionate, the tolerant but incredulous smile of a man of the world, and the cold ascetic smile that shows a woman that her shallow soul has been read all too easily. Pastimes abandoned only with the purely decorative application of shaving lather to his girlish chin. However,
As his unbeetling brow was left unobscured, he was able to pursue his physiognomical researches and to produce for his continued enlightenment a versatile repertory of frowns, the stern, the quizzical, the bitter, the treacherous, the bold, the agonized, the inquisitive, the ducal, and the frown of the husband who says, "I forgive you. Go." A few minutes later, Mr. Chester, abruptly pausing in the operation of fastening his collar, bent a sudden, passionate interest upon his right forearm, without apparent cause and with the air of never having seen it until that moment. He clenched his fingers tightly, producing a slight stringiness above the wrist, then crooked his elbow with intensity, noting this enormous effect in all the mirrors. Regretfully, he let his shirt sleeves fall and veil the rare but private beauties just discovered, rested his left hand negligently upon his hip, extended his right in a gesture of flawlessly aristocratic grace, and, with a slight inclination of his head, uttered aloud these simple but befitting words, "I thank ye, my good people." Two young maester was greeting the loyal tenantry who acclaimed his return to Fielding Manor, a flowered progress thoroughly incomprehensible to the Pullman porter whose transfixed eye, glazed upon an old gold face intruded through the narrow doorway, Mr. Chester encountered in the glass above the nickeled washbasins. The Libyan withdrew in a cloud of silence, and young maester, flushing somewhat, resumed his toilette with annoyed precision and no more embroidery. He had yesterday completed his sophomore year. The brushes he applied to his now adult locks were those of a junior, and a man's age had come to a man's cares and responsibilities. Several long years had rolled away since for the last time he had made himself sick on a train in a club car orgy of kebabs and sarsaparilla pop. Zigzagging through shoe-bordered aisles of sleepers in morning dishevelment, he sought the dining car, where the steward escorted him to an end table for two. He would have assumed his seat with that air of negligent hauteur, which was his chosen manner for public appearance, had not the train, taking a curve at high speed, heaved him into the undesirable embrace of an elderly man breakfasting across the aisle. "Keep your feet, sonny, keep your feet," said this barbarian, little witting that he had addressed a member of the 19-something prom committee. People at the next table laughed genially, and Mr. Chester, muttering a word of hostile apology, catapulted into his assigned place, his cheeks hot with the triple outrage. He relieved himself a little by the icy repulsion with which he countered the cordial advances of the waiter, who took his order and wished him a good morning, hoped he had slept well, declared the weather delightful, and unanswered, yet preserved his beautiful courtesy unimpaired. When his humble ambassador had departed on his mission to the kitchen, Henry Millick Chester, unwarrantably persuaded that all eyes were searching his every inch and angle, an impression not uncharacteristic of his years, gazed out of the window with an indifference which would have been obtrusive if any of the other breakfasters had happened to notice it. The chill exclusiveness of his expression was a rebuke to such prying members of the proletariat as might be striving to read his thoughts, and barred his fellow passengers from every privilege of his consideration. The intensely reserved gentleman was occupied with interests which were the perquisites of only his few existing peers in birth, position, and intelligence, none of whom, patently, was in the car. He looked freezingly upon the abashed landscape, which fled in shame, nor was that wintry stare relaxed when the steward placed someone opposite him at the little table. Nay, our frosty scholar now intensified the bleakness of his isolation, retiring quite to the pole in reproval of this too close intrusion. He resolutely denied the existence of this vis-a-vis, refused consciousness of his humanity, even of its sex, and then inconsistently began to perspire with the horrible impression that it was glaring at him fixedly. It was a dreadful feeling. He felt himself growing red and coughed vehemently to afford the public an explanation of his change of color. At last, his suffering grown unendurable, he desperately turned his eyes full upon the newcomer. She was not looking at him at all, but down at the edge of the white cloth on her own side of the table, and she was the very prettiest girl he had ever seen in his life. She was about his own age. Her prettiness was definitely extreme, and its fair delicacy was complete and without any imperfection whatever. She was dressed in pleasant shades of tan and brown. A brown veil misted the rim of her hat. Tan gloves were folded back from her wrists, and they and all she wore were fresh and trim and ungrimed by the dusty journey. She was charming. Henry Millick Chester's first gasping appraisal of her was perfectly accurate, for she was a peach, or a rose, or anything that is dewy and fresh and delectable. She was indeed some smooth. She was the smoothest thing in the world, and the world knows it. She looked up. Henry Millick Chester was lost. At the same instant that the gone feeling came over him, she dropped her eyes again to the edge of the table. Who can tell if she knew what she had done? The conversation began with appalling formalities, which preluded the most convenient placing of a sugar bowl and the replenishing of an exhausted salt cellar. When the weather, spurned as the placative offer of the gentle waiter, fell from the lips of the princess in words of diamonds and rubies and pearls, our Henry took up the weather where she left it. He put it to its utmost. He went forward with it, prophesying weather. He went backward with it, recalling weather. He spun it out and out, while she agreed to all he said, until his overworked weather got so stringy that each obscurely felt it to be hideous. The thread broke. Fragments wandered in the air for a few moments, but disappeared. A desperate propriety descended, and they fell into silence over their eggs. Frantically, Mr. Chester searched his mind for some means to pursue the celestial encounter. According to the rules, something ought to happen that would reveal her as Patricia Beekman, the sister of his roommate Schuyler Beekman, and tonight he should be handling the imperturbable Dawkins a wire to send. My dear Schuyler, I married your sister this afternoon. But it seemed unlikely, because his roommate's name was Jake Schmalls, and Jake lived in Cedar Rapids. And besides, this train wasn't even coming or going to Palm Beach. It was going to St. Louis eventually, and now hustled earnestly across the placid and largely unbutlered plains of Ohio. Often, as everyone knows, people have been lost to each other forever through the lack of a word, and few have realized this more poignantly than our Henry, as he helplessly suffered the precious minutes to accumulate vacancy. True, he had thought of something to say, yet he abandoned it. Probably he was wiser to wait, as what he thought of saying was, "Will you be my wife?" It might seem premature, he feared. The strain was relieved by a heavenly accident, which saved the life of a romance near perishing at birth. That charming girl, relaxing slightly in her chair, made some small, indefinite, and entirely ladylike movement of restfulness that reached its gentle culmination upon the 2 feet of Mr. Chester, which, obviously mistaken for structural adjuncts to the table, were thereby glorified and became beautiful on the mountains. He was not the man to criticize the remarkable ignorance of dining car table architecture, thus displayed, nor did he in any wise resent being mistaken up to the ankles for metal or wood. No, the light pressure of her small heels hardly indented the stout toes of his brown shoes. The soles of her slippers reposed upon his 2 insteps, and rapture shook his soul to its foundation, while the ineffable girl gazed lustrously out of the window, the clear serenity of her brilliant eyes making plain her complete unconsciousness of the nature of what added to her new comfort. A terrific blush sizzled all over him, and to conceal its visible area, he bent low over his coffee. She was unaware. He was transported. She, to his eyes, transfigured. Glamour diffused itself about her, sprayed them both like showers of impalpable gold dust, and filled the humble dining car. It filled the world. Transformed, seraphic waiters passed up and down the aisle in a sort of obscure radiance, A nimbus hovered faintly above the brown veil. A secret luminosity was exhaled by the very tablecloth, where an angel's pointed figures droned absently. It would be uncharitable to believe that a spirit of retaliation inspired the elderly and now replete man across the aisle, and yet, when he rose, he fell upon the neck of Henry as Henry had fallen upon his, and the shock of it jarred four shoes from the acute neighborliness of their juxtaposition. The accursed graybeard, giggling in his senility, passed on, but that angel leaped backward in her chair while her beautiful eyes, wide open, stunned, her beautiful mouth, wide open, incredulous, gave proof that horror can look bewitching.
"Murder!" she gasped. "Were those your feet?"
And as he could compass no articulate reply, she grew as pink as he, murmured inaudibly, and stared at him in wider and wilder amazement.
It didn't hurt,"
he finally managed to stammer. At this, she covered her blushes with her two hands and began to gurgle and shake with laughter. She laughed and laughed and laughed. It became a paroxysm. He laughed too, because she laughed. Other passengers looked at them and laughed. The waiters laughed. They approved. Colored waiters always approve of laughter, and a merry spirit went aboard in the car. At last, she controlled herself long enough to ask,
"But what did you think of me?"
It didn't hurt," he repeated idiotically, to his own mortification, for he passionately aspired to say something airy and winsome, but as he couldn't think of anything like that, he had to let it go. "Oh, not at all," he added feebly. However, though not so deep as well, it served. 'Twas enough, for she began to laugh again, and there loomed no further barrier in the way of acquaintance. Therefore, it was pleasantly without constraint, and indeed, as a matter of course, that he dropped into a chair beside her half an hour later, in the observation car, and something in the way she let the Illustrated London News slide into the vacant chair on the other side of her might have suggested that she expected him.
"I was still wondering what you must have thought of me."
This gave him an opportunity, because he had thought out a belated reply for the first time she had said it. Hence, quick as a flash, he made the dashing rejoinder.
"It wasn't so much what I thought of you, but what I thought of myself. I thought I was in heaven."
She must have known what pretty sounds her laughter made. She laughed a great deal. She even had a way of laughing in the middle of some of her words, and it gave them a kind of ripple. There are girls who naturally laugh like that. Others learn to, a few won't, and some can't. It isn't fair for the ones that can't.
"But you oughtn't to tell me that," she said.
It was in the middle of "oughtn't" that she rippled. A pen cannot express it, and no one has yet invented a way of writing with a flute, but the effect on Henry shows what a wonderful ripple it was. Henry trembled. From this moment, she had only to ripple to make Henry tremble. Henry was more in love than he had been at breakfast. Henry was a goner.
"Why oughtn't I to?" he demanded with white intensity. "If anything's true, it's right to tell it, isn't it? I believe that everybody has a right to tell the truth, don't you?"
"Yes."
"You take the case of a man that's in love," said this rather precipitate gentleman. "Isn't it right for him to..."
"But suppose,"
she interrupted, becoming instantly serious with the introduction of the great topic,
"suppose he isn't really in love. Don't you think there are a few cases of people truly and deeply caring for each other? There are men,"
he said firmly,
"who know how to love truly and deeply, and could never in their lives care for anybody but the woman they have picked out. I don't say all men feel that way. I don't think they do. But there are a few that are capable of it."
The seats in an observation car are usually near neighbors, and it happened that the brown cuff of a tan sleeve, extended reposefully on the arm of her chair, just touched the back of his hand, which rested on the arm of his. This ethereally light contact continued. She had no apparent cognizance of it, but a vibrant thrill passed through him, and possibly quite a hearty little fire might have been built under him without perceiving good cause for moving. He shook, gulped, and added,
"I am."
But how could you be sure of that? She said thoughtfully, until you tried.
And as he seemed about to answer, perhaps too impulsively, she checked him with a smiling,
At your age!
You don't know how old I am. I am older than you.
How old are you?
21 next March.
What day?
The 7th.
That is singular. Why?
Because, she began in a low tone, and with full recognition of the solemn import of the revelation.
Because my birthday is only one day after yours. I was 20 years old the 8th of last March.
By George!
The exclamation came from him, husky with awe. There was a faithful silence.
Yes, I was born on the 8th, she said slowly.
And me on the 7th.
At such a time, no man is a purist.
It is strange, she said.
Strange! I came into the world just one day before you did.
They looked at each other curiously, deeply stirred. Coincidence could not account for these birthdays of theirs, nor chance for their meeting on a train like this. Henry Millick Chester was breathless. The mysteries were glimpsed. No doubt was possible. He and the wondrous creature at his side were meant for each other, intended from the beginning of eternity. She dropped her eyes slowly from his, but he was satisfied that she had felt the marvel precisely as he had felt it.
"Don't you think," she said gently, "that a girl has seen more of the world at 20 than a man?"
Mr. Chester well wished to linger upon the subject of birthdays. However, the line of original research suggested by her question was alluring also.
"Yes and no,"
he answered with admirable impartiality.
"In some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
For instance, you take the case of a man that's in love."
"Well,"
interrupted the lady,
"I think, for instance, that a girl understands men better at 20 than men do women."
"It may be," he admitted, nodding. "I like to think about deeper things like this sometimes."
"So do I. I think they're interesting," she said with that perfect sympathy of understanding which he believed she was destined to extend to him always and in all things. "Life itself is interesting, don't you think so?"
"I think it's the most interesting subject there can be. Real life, that is, though, not just on the surface. Now, for instance, you take the case of a man that's in..."
"Do you go in much for reading?" she asked.
"Sure. But as I was saying, you take..."
"I think reading gives us so many ideas, don't you?"
"Yes, I get a lot out of it.
I do, too. I try to read only the best things," she said. "I don't believe in reading everything, and there's so much to read nowadays that isn't really good."
"Who do you think," he inquired with deference, "is the best author now?"
It was not a question to be settled quite offhand. She delayed her answer slightly, then, with a gravity appropriate to the literary occasion, temporized,
"Well, since Victor Hugo is dead, it's hard to say just who is the best."
"Yes, it is," he agreed. "We get that in English course in college. There aren't any great authors anymore. I expect probably Swinburne's the best."
She hesitated.
"Perhaps, but more as a poet."
He assented.
"Yes, that's so. I expect he would be classed more as a poet. Come to think of it, I believe he's dead, too. I'm not sure, though. Maybe it was Beerbohm Tree. Somebody like that. I've forgotten. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I didn't mean poetry. I meant, who do you think writes the best books? Mrs. Humphrey Ward?"
"Yes, she's good. And so's Henry James."
"I've never read anything by Henry James. I guess I'll read some of his this summer. What's the best one to begin on?"
The exquisite pink of her cheeks extended its area almost imperceptibly.
"Oh, anyone. They're all pretty good. Do you care for nature?"
"Sure thing," he returned quickly. "Do you?"
"I love it."
"So do I. I can't do much for mathematics, though."
"Brrr!" She shivered prettily.
I hate it.
So do I. I can't give astronomy a whole lot either. She turned a softly reproachful inquiry upon him.
Oh, don't you love to look at the stars?
In horror, lest the entrancing being think him a brute, he responded with breathless haste.
Oh, rather! To look at 'em, sure thing. I meant astronomy in college. That's mostly math, you know, just figures. The stars to look at. Of course, that's different. Why, I look up at 'em for hours sometimes.
He believed what he was saying.
I look up at 'em and think and think and think. So do I.
Her voice was low and hushed. There was something almost holy in the sound of it, and a delicate glow suffused her lovely upraised face.
Like that picture of St. Cecilia, he thought.
Oh, I love the stars, and music, and flowers.
And birds,
he added automatically in a tone that, could it by some miracle have been heard at home, would have laid his 9-year-old brother flat on the floor in a might-be mortal swoon. A sweet warmth centered in the upper part of his diaphragm and softly filtered throughout him. The delicious future held no doubts or shadows for him, it was assured. He and this perfect woman had absolutely identical tastes. Their abhorrences and their enthusiasms marched together. They would never know a difference in all their lives to come. Destiny unrolled before him a shining pathway, which they two would walk hand in hand through the summer days to a calm and serene autumn, respected and admired by the world, but finding ever their greatest and most sacred joy in the light of each other's eyes, that light none other than the other could evoke. Could it be possible, he wondered, that he was the same callow boy who but yesterday pranced and exulted in the parade of the new juniors? How absurd and purposeless that old life seemed. How far away, how futile, and how childish. Well, it was over. By this time tomorrow he would have begun his business career. Back in the old life, he had expected to go through law school after graduating from college, subsequently to enter his father's office. That meant 5 years before even beginning to practice, an idea merely laughable now. There was a men's furnishing store on a popular corner at home. It was an establishment which had always attracted him, and what pleasanter way to plow the road to success than through acres of variously woven fabrics, richly colored silk, delicate linens, silver mountings, and odorous leathers in congenial association with neckties, walking sticks, hosiery, and stockpins. He would be at home a few hours hence, and he would not delay. After lunch, he would go boldly to his father and say,
"Father, I have reached man's estate, and I have put away childish things. I have made up my mind upon a certain matter, and you will only waste time by any effort to alter this. My firm determination, Father, I here and now relinquish all legal ambitions, for the reason that a mercantile career is more suited to my inclinations and my abilities. Father, I have met the one and only woman I can ever care for, and I intend to make her my wife. Father, you have always dealt squarely with me. I will deal squarely with you. I ask you the simple question, will you or will you not advance me the funds to purchase an interest in Paul H. Hoy and Company's men's outfitting establishment? If you will not, then I shall seek help elsewhere."
Walking dreams are as swift, sometimes as the other kind, which we hear thread mazes so labyrinthine, between the opening and the closing of a door, and a 20-year-old fancy fermenting in the enclosure of a 6 7/8 plaid cap, effervesces with a power of sizzling and sparkling and popping.
"I believe I love music best of all," the girl said dreamily. "Do you play?" he asked,
and his tone and look were those of one who watches at the sick bed of a valued child.
"Yes, a little. I love the piano."
He was untroubled by any remorse for what he and some of his gang had done only 2 days since,
to a previously fine instrument in his dormitory entry. He had forgotten the dead past in his present vision, which was of a luxurious room in a spacious mansion, and a tired man of affairs coming quietly into that room from a conference at which he had just consolidated the haberdashery trade of the world, and sinking noiselessly upon a rich divan, while a beautiful woman in a dress of brown and tan, her hair slightly silvered, played to him through the twilight upon a grand piano, the only other sound in the great house being the softly murmured voices of perfectly trained children, being put to bed in a distant nursery upstairs. "I like the stage, too," she said.
"Don't you? Did you see the Tinkle-Dinkle Girl?"
"Yes, I liked it."
"It's a peach show," he spoke with warranted authority.
During the university term just finished, he had gone 8 times to New York and had enriched his critical perceptions of music and the drama by 10 visits to the Tinkle-Dinkle Girl, 2 of his excursions having fallen on matinee days.
"Those big birds that played the comedy parts were funny birds, weren't they?"
"The Tramp and the Brewer. Yes, awfully funny."
"We'll go lots to the theater."
He spoke eagerly and with superb simplicity, quite without consciousness that he was skipping much that would usually be thought necessarily intermediate. An enchanting vision engrossed his mind's eye. He saw himself night after night at the Tinkle-Dinkle Girl, his lovely wife beside him, growing matronly perhaps, but slenderly matronly, with a grace of years that only added to her beauty, and always wearing tan gloves and a brown veil. The bewilderment of her expression was perhaps justified.
"What?"
At this he realized the import of what he had said and what, in a measure, it did assume. He became pinkish, then pink, then more pink, and so did she. Paralyzed, the blushing pair looked at each other throughout this duet in color, something like the glint of alarm, beginning to show through the wide astonishment in her eyes, and with the perception of this he was assailed by an acute perturbation. He had spoken thoughtlessly, even hastily, he feared. He should have given her more time. Would she rise now with chilling dignity and leave him? It might be forever. Was he to lose her just when he had found her? He shuddered at the ghastly abyss of loneliness disclosed by the possibility. But this was only the darkest moment before a radiance that shot heavenward like the flaming javelins of an equatorial sunrise. Her eyes lowered slowly till the long brown lashes shadowed the rose-colored cheek, and the fall of her glance came to rest upon the arms of their 2 chairs, where the edge of her coat sleeve just touched the knuckle of his little finger. 2 people were passing in front of them. There was no one who could see, and with a lightning swift impulse, she turned her wrist, and for half a second, while his heart stopped beating, touched all his fingers with her own, then as quickly withdrew her hand and turned away far from him as the position of her chair permitted. It was a caress of incredible brevity, and so fleeting, so airy, that it was little more than a touch of light itself, like the faint, quick light from a flying star one might just glimpse on one's hand as it passed. But in our pleasant world, important things have resulted from touches as evanescent as that. Nature has its uses for the ineffable. Blazing with glory, dumb with rapture, Henry Millick Chester felt his heart rebound to its work, while his withheld breath upheaved in a gulp that half suffocated him. Thus, blinded by the revelation of the stupefying beauty of life, he sat through a heaven-stricken interval, and time was of no moment. Gradually he began to perceive, in the midst of the effulgence, which surrounded the next chair like a bright mist, the adorable contour of a shoulder in a tan coat, and the ravishing outline of a rosy cheek that belonged to this divine girl who was his. By and by he became dreamily aware of other objects beyond that cheek and that shoulder,
of a fat man and his fat wife on the opposite side of the car near the end. Unmistakably, they were man and wife. But it seemed to Henry that they had no reason to be. Such people had no right to be married. They had no obvious right to exist at all. Certainly, they had no right whatever to exist in that car. Their relationship to each other had become a sickening commonplace, the bleakness of it as hideously evident as their overfed convexity. It was visible that they looked upon each other as inevitable nuisances which had to be tolerated. They were horrible. Had love ever known these people? It was unthinkable. For lips such as theirs to have pronounced the name of God would have been blasphemy. For those fat hands ever to have touched desecration, Henry hated the despicable pair. All at once his emotion changed. He did not hate them. He pitied them. From an immense height he looked down with compassion upon their wretched condition. He pitied everybody, except himself and the roseate behind him. They floated together upon a tiny golden cloud, alone in the vast sky, at an immeasurable altitude above the squalid universe. A wave of pity for the rest of mankind flooded over him. But most of all, he pitied that miserable, sodden, befleshed old married couple. He was dimly aware of a change that came over these fat people, a strangeness. But he never did realize that at this crisis his eyes, fixed intently upon them and aided by his plastic countenance, had expressed his feelings and sentiments regarding them in the most vivid and lively way. For at the moment when the stout gentleman laid his paper down, preparatory to infuriated inquiry, both he and his wife were expunged from Henry's consciousness forever, and were seen of him henceforth no more than if they had been ether and not solid flesh. The exquisite girl had been pretending to pick a thread out of her left sleeve with her right hand, but now at least she leaned back in her chair and again turned her face partly toward Henry. Her underlip was caught in slightly beneath her upper teeth, as if she had been doing something that possibly she oughtn't to be doing. And though the pause in the conversation had been protracted, it is impossible to calculate how long, her charming features were still becomingly overspread with rose. She looked toward her rapt companion, not at him, and her eyes preoccupied, tender, and faintly embarrassed. The pause continued. He leaned a little closer to her, and he looked at her, and looked at her, and looked at her. At intervals his lips moved as if he were speaking, and yet he was thinking wordlessly. Leaning thus toward her, his gaze and attitude had all the intensity of one who watches a ninth-inning tie in the deciding game of the championship series, and as he looked and looked and looked, the fat man and his wife, quite unaware of their impalpability, also looked and looked and looked in grateful fascination.
"Did you?"
Henry Millick Chester finally spoke these words in a voice he had borrowed, evidently from a stranger, for it did not fit his throat and was so deep that it disappeared. It seemed to fall down a coal hole and ended in a dusty choke.
"Did you?"
He began again, two octaves higher, and immediately squeaked out. He said, "Did you?" five times before he subjugated the other two words.
"Did you mean that?"
"What?" Her voice was so low that he divined, rather than heard, what she said. He leaned even a little closer, and the fat man nudged his wife, who elbowed his thumb out of her side morbidly. She wasn't missing anything.
Did you mean that?"
"Mean what?"
"That."
"I don't know what you mean."
When you, oh, you know."
"No, I don't."
When you took my hand."
"I?"
With sudden, complete self-possession, she turned quickly to face him, giving him a look of half-shocked, half-amused astonishment.
When I took your hand, she repeated incredulously. What are you saying?
You know,
he stammered.
A while ago, when you...
I didn't do anything of the kind.
Impending indignation began to cloud the delicate face ominously.
Why in the world should I?
But you...
I didn't.
She cut him off sharply.
I couldn't. Why, it wouldn't have been nice. What made you dream I would do a thing like that? How dare you imagine such things?
At first dumbfounded, then appalled, he took the long, swift, sickening descent from his golden cloud with his mouth open, but it snapped tight at the bump with which he struck the earth. He lay prone, dismayed, abject. The lovely witch could have made him believe anything. At least it is the fact that for a moment she made him believe he had imagined that angelic little caress. And perhaps it was the sight of his utter subjection that melted her. For she flashed upon him suddenly with a dazing smile, and then, blushing again but more deeply than before, her whole attitude admitting and yielding, she offered full and amazing confession, her delicious laugh rippling tremulously throughout every word of it.
It must have been an accident.
Partly.
I love you,
he shouted. The translucent fat man and his wife groped for each other feverishly, and a colored porter touched Henry Millick Chester on the shoulder.
Be in Richmond in less than 5 minutes now, said the porter.
He tapped the youth's shoulders twice more. It is his office to awaken the rapt dreamer.
Richmond, Indiana, less than 5 minutes now,
he repeated more slowly. Henry gave him a stunned and disheveled,
What?
You get off Richmond, don't you?
What of it? We haven't passed Dayton yet.
Yes, sir, long ago. Past Dayton 8:50. Be in Richmond mighty quick now.
The porter appeared to be a malicious liar. Henry appealed pitifully to the girl.
But we haven't passed Dayton?
Yes, just after you sat down with me. We stopped several minutes.
Yes, sir. Train don't stop no minutes in Richmond, though,
said the porter with a hard laugh, waving his little broom at some outlying freight cars they were passing.
Getting in now. I got your bag on platform.
I don't want to be brushed,
Henry said, almost sobbing.
For heaven's sake, get out!
Porters expect anything. This one went out solemnly without even lifting his eyebrows. The brakes were going on. One class of railway tragedies is never recorded. Though it is the most numerous of all and fills the longest list of heartbreaks, the statistics ignore it. Yet no train ever leaves its shed or moves that is not party to it. It is time and overtime that the safety device inventor should turn their best attention to it, so that the happy day may come at last when we shall see our common carriers equipped with something to prevent these lovers' partings. The train began to slow down. Henry Millick Chester got waveringly to his feet. She rose at the same time and stood beside him.
I am no boy,
he began, hardly knowing what he said, but automatically quoting a fragment from his forthcoming address to his father.
I have reached man's estate, and I have met the only...
He stopped short with an exclamation of horror.
You haven't even told me your name.
My name?
The girl said, a little startled.
Yes, and your address.
I'm not on my way home now, she said. I've been visiting in New York, and I'm going to St. Louis to make another visit.
But your name?
She gave him an odd glance of mockery, a little troubled. You mightn't like my name.
Oh, please, please.
Besides, do you think it's quite proper for me to...
Oh, please, to talk of that now, please.
The train had stopped. The glint of a sudden decision shone in the lovely eyes.
I'll write it for you so you won't forget.
She went quickly to the writing desk at the end of the compartment, he with her. The eyes of the fat man and his wife
following them like two pairs of searchlights swung by the same mechanism.
"And where you live," urged Henry. "I shall write you every day."
He drew a long, deep breath and threw back his head.
"Till the day when I come for you."
"Don't look over my shoulder,"
she laughed shyly, wrote hurriedly upon a loose sheet, placed it in an envelope, sealed the envelope, and then, as he reached to take it, withheld it tantalizingly.
"No,
it's my name and where I live, but you can't have it. Not till you've promised not to open it until the train is clear out of the station." Outside the window sounded the twice repeated, "All aboard," and far ahead a fatal bell was clanking.
"I promise,"
he gulped.
"Then take it."
With a strange, newborn masterfulness, he made a sudden, impetuous gesture and lifted both the precious envelope and the fingers that enclosed it to his lips. Then he turned and dashed to the forward end of the car, where a porter remained untipped as Henry leapt from the already rapidly moving steps of the car to the ground. Instantly, the wonderful girl was drawn past him, leaning and waving from the railed rear platform where she had run for this farewell. And in the swift last look that they exchanged, there was in her still flushing lovely face a light of tenderness and of laughter, of kindness and of something like a fleeting regret. The train gained momentum, skimming onward and away, the end of the observation card dwindling and condensing itself like a magician's disappearing card, while a white handkerchief, waving from the platform, quickly became an infinitesimal shred of white. And then there was nothing. The girl was gone. Probably Henry Millick Chester owes his life to the fact that there are no gates between the station building and the tracks at Richmond. For gates and a ticket-clipping official might have delayed Henry's father in the barely successful dash he made to drag from the path of a backing local a boy wholly lost to the outward world in a state of helpless puzzlement, which already threatened to become permanent as he stared and stared at a sheet of railway notepaper whereon was written in a charming hand, "Mary Smith, Chicago, Illinois." This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
While digging for artifacts in the far north, Professor Quantum found a perfectly preserved body of a man. He was overjoyed. He believed the frozen body was none other than Adam from the Bible. What convinced Quantum of that?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The body was missing what Adam would be missing, a belly button. What Quantum didn't know, however, is that a rare condition called umbilical aplasia causes some people, other than Adam, to be born without a belly button.
And now back to our regular programming.